Today's program was brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons, producing the country's best dry, cured, and aged hams, bacon, and sausage using 100% pasture-raised, certified humane Berkshire cuts. For more information, visit edwardsvaham.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning and welcome back to Taste Matters. It's a new year and a new show, and we're so excited to be celebrating 2014 this in a chilly way. Everyone's sitting here in the studio in scarves and sweaters. You know we're live. It's a frigid polar vortex of a show, and someone's here to warm it up. I'm so excited to have in the studio with me today Liz Newmark, who is someone I've had the pleasure of working with over many years in various capacities. She is the founder of Great Performances, one of the great New York-based catering companies. They've done many things you probably didn't even know of, and then many things that you do know of. They deal with food service and wonderful cultural institutions, great institutes, the inauguration, I hear, all yep. sorts of amazing things. And we'll talk a little bit about that. But even, I think, more engaging, Liz is such an important citizen of this city, I have to say, a third-generation New Yorker who, we'll hear the story, started a farm and a center to educate children about how the importance of food and where food comes from and the importance of eating together. And some of that work, in addition to the work at Great Performances, has led to a new book called Sylvia's Table that we're going to talk about, or at least use as a starting point for our conversation. Thank you for joining us today.
A pleasure. Great to be here.
So let's start with the book a little bit. There's this beautiful book. It's about farm and community and family and delicious food. And I just learned you took the beautiful pictures. You are a multi-talented person. Tell us a little bit about the project of the book, and we'll go deeper into the center, the farm, and then the city that you love so much and are such an important part of.
Okay, well, we have 3-4 hours, so
perfect.
We'll cover everything.
It's internet radio. No one cares.
Okay. In a nutshell, the book really came from a place of passion. And when people ask me to give sort of a soundbite for it, I'm stunned because it's impossible. And sometimes I just say, you know, it's a book about life with recipes.
That's good. Okay.
And I think every cookbook has a unique reason for coming into being. And for me, it is a tribute book. And it's called Sylvia's Table in memory and in honor of Sylvia, who was my youngest daughter, who died very suddenly at the age of 6. And it's a story of finding a way back. Mm. Because it was, as anyone can imagine, it's
hard to imagine, yes.
There are no words. And yet, I needed to find my way back, which brought me to the farm project and creating the Sylvia Center. And as part of what I wanted to tell in a story, I wanted to write this book.
Right. So to pull those pieces together.
Right.
Let's talk about the farm. I mean, we'll get to the other pieces, sure. Because I think that one of the things that is so, it's the unifying element of the story, because we talk a lot these days, especially here at Heritage Radio, about the importance of farm to table, and chefs are interested in ingredients and everything. But farm is much bigger here. The farm is a metaphor for something much larger, and I think it's beautifully in the text and in the photos and in the recipes themselves. It's beautifully illuminated how it's the piece that pulls all these diverse elements of life and city and country together. Talk about why a farm. What's a farm?
Well, why a farm? That's a great question, because, like you said, I'm a third generation Manhattanite,
right?
And farm just is not in my makeup. But I think I attribute it to some distant Russian gene. Having been in food service, in food hospitality for so long, as you grow, you sometimes, what I found, we were getting further and further away from the very basic building blocks of our industry, which is seasonal, fresh, from the farm food. And you start to go crazy. I remember 10, 20 years ago, we all used to say, Our purchasers source food from all corners of the globe.
Right.
I mean, you get so out of touch with where food is coming from.
And well, I would imagine, especially in a catering company, that's what people wanted. The most exotic things on my table from as far away as they could come.
And the more exotic, the more pride we all had.
Right.
And it just seemed that I wanted to connect us back to some core values on food, which is really seeing it in the most natural state, understanding that when it's raining, it's good for the farmer. When it's a drought, it's bad for the farmer. Just it's a broader life experience. And then in the aftermath of losing Sylvia and figuring out how I was going to wake up in the morning and go to work where people were obsessing about details that were just hard for me to relate to, the color of a cloth and the size of an hors d'oeuvre.
Interesting.
You know, it all clicked, and I said, you know, I've been dreaming about this farm. I'm going to buy the farm, find a farm, find property, buy a farm, and start the Sylvia Center and segue a lot of things that were just bubbling around and into a new project.
How long ago was that?
That was in
2005.
So a little bit before green was the new black.
So you found a beautiful piece of property in Putnam County? Is it?
Well, it's at Columbia County.
Okay,
looked at over 50 different properties in the tri-state area.
Wow.
And I knew I did not want to be going through a tunnel on a Sunday night, not want to be crossing a Jersey Hudson River Bridge. And went straight up the Taconic and found 60 beautiful acres that were just abandoned. Well, I think somebody thought they would develop something on it at some point. 1960s kind of house on it, wooded property, pond, and I just fell in love with it.
Huh. And you named it Kachki Farms, which I love is not an Indian word, actually, but you tell some people sometimes that it is.
Well, the Kachkis, the Mohegans, the Taconics, they were all
the Cohens and the Levies also,
More related to the Cohens, yeah. It's a Yiddish word, and it means duck. And it's just a term of endearment. When my son Sam was born, again, something bubbled up, and I looked at him and nicknamed him Kachki.
Funny.
And he's actually quite handsome. There's nothing duck-like about him.
Are there ducks on the farm, at least?
There are geese.
Okay.
Yeah,
we'll
no
take
ducks.
And then you start, grow things. You find farmers, I presume, or people to help you to develop the land, or how does... that's
people,
a sigh. That's a telling sigh.
If you have this dream that you want to start a farm and you want to talk to someone, I'm really not the person you should ask. No, it's ignorance is bliss.
Right.
We found this property. There were a few soggy spots. I figured the tractor goes around them. Fast forward 40,000 feet of drainage pipe later, don't go around them. You drain the property. But I did not know that. I initially had a farmer in mind, and that didn't work out. So, it's 2005. Where do you find a farmer? Jean-Paul from Roxbury has property, a farm across the street. Mm. We were talking. He says, I got just the guy for you. You know, okay, sure. And 2 weeks later, I'm sitting in the Taconic Diner, and I meet Bob Walker, who's 6'3". You know, hands look like they could hold the world in them. And, I say it was love at first sight, and he became our farmer.
Wow.
So,
and then you go about producing food, which you have dealt with your entire life, and it came in one door. You know, you made an order that night, or presumably the next day came in a door. And then the reality of growing and weather and seasons. Mother Nature, it becomes very, very real all of a sudden.
I think the hardest part, and seven harvest seasons later, I would say the hardest part still is matching what we want as a catering company or cafes to what's available on the farm. And making those two, that supply and demand meet is the toughest after all the trials and tribulations and learning and building and dollars. That is still the toughest piece. And our solution actually is that we've moved to probably about 80% CSA model. With our produce.
So explain, probably for Heritage Radio listeners, you don't need to explain CSA.
Right.
But CSA is Community Supported Agriculture.
Right.
So you have members who you deliver shares of the crop to.
Correct. And what we've done, which is a very interesting hybrid, which is perfect for a Kachke Farm Grade Performances scenario, is that they are workplace CSAs. So instead of, I think we have two or three community centers, but we have around 25 businesses where we deliver into the office
and
prepackaged.
The employees, take their stuff home. I would take that. We should have that at the Beard House. That sounds great.
Well, you could have it again. And it's great because our companies are everybody from law firms, financial firms. The mayor's office did one for 2 years.
Wow.
Just an incredible array of New York kinds of businesses.
I'd like to go back to something you mentioned, because I think we often, you know, we fantasize about the farm-to-table thing, and chefs use the phrase all the time, but what you said about the difference between the difficulty of aligning what you grow to what you sell or cook or produce is something that I don't think we always understand the intricacies of. I've spoken to David Kinch at Manresa, who has a restaurant that is sort of driven by the farm. They have several acres, and even there, where he can decide that day pretty much what's going to be on the menu, he says the hardest thing is to see what you've got and figure out what you can do with it. It isn't it runs you. You don't run it because of all of these other things. So I'd just like to explore that a little.
It is so amazing. I think we come out of this very entitled and empowered New York food culture where we can have anything we want anytime, anywhere. I could call any number of vendors and get 100 pounds of anything on my doorstep tomorrow. But when you're growing it, It's beyond your control.
Right.
It might be ready a day earlier, a day later. The arugula might be ready right on time, but you know what? It's got little bite marks and little holes, the whole thing. Are you going to use that or not? Is your customer going
to
freak out about
it?
The labor aspect is a whole nother conversation. Very, very hard, because the biggest expense on a farm on a day-to-day basis, of course, is labor. It's all labor.
Right.
So it's really, and then enough. You know, you have a bride who won Shard. You need enough on, you know, the
right
day. You don't need it before. You don't need it after. You don't need a little bit. And
and
not everybody's flexible.
Of course not. I mean, in catering especially, where these things are booked a year in advance and the menu is set.
And it's printed.
Right. And weddings. I mean, forget all the other things, but, you know, you can't change that.
So it's a lot of education, whether you're in a restaurant and you can educate not only your customers, but your internal customers, your chefs, your staff, to be flexible, because if you're pulling in, something looks good, it comes up, you want to put it on the menu, you've got to get the buy-in from your team to try something new. So we find a lot of flexibility. Our venue chefs can get very excited about a pop-up food item.
Right.
But I think as a regular diet for them, I think people like predictability, and we're all in a very bottom-line driven landscape. So having that ongoing, always flexibility, I'd imagine it's really hard.
Right. I think it's important for people to understand that there's the idea, and then there's the reality of running the business and dealing with the intricacies required of operating. There are structural changes that have to happen in addition to the education. It's really important for people to remember. Before we have to take a quick break, how do the beautiful recipes in this book relate to the business or the food you eat? Where's the inspiration from? I mean, they're so obviously produce heavy, farm rich recipes.
Right.
Where'd they come from?
Well, it's interesting. The book took several years. Mm-hmm. And anybody who's written a book, anybody gets it done in a year and a half, they have my absolute respect. It took about 4 years. And in the course of writing it, I went from being an omnivore to being a vegetarian with a little sidestep into veganism, which I think everybody should try, and then back to pescatarianism. So my love of produce comes singing through. A lot of it are recipes I have cooked at home. A lot of them are recipes that we cook at great performances mm-hmm. or inspired by great performances. I have about 24 wonderful guest chefs who have contributed recipes. And then a lot of them come from our Sylvia Center program, because I really wanted to tie in the notion of life happens in the kitchen. It happens around food. So many people are so nervous about cooking, yeah. and I don't get it. So these are really very approachable recipes, I think.
So we're going to talk more about that when we come back after a brief break, and we'll talk about the Sylvia Center and a bunch of other wonderful things. I'm with Liz Newmark, the founder of Great Performances and of Catch Key Farms, and the author very recently, although it took 4 years to happen, along with Carol Lally, of Sylvia's Table, fresh seasonal recipes from our farm to your family. This is Taste Matters. We'll be right back.
Like what you hear so far? Support the network and become a member. Membership helps us bring you the best food radio in the world and gives you access to thousands of dollars in discounts at the sustainably minded businesses that support us. To become a member, visit heritageradionetwork.org today. The following program was brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons. Edwards Suriano hams are aged to perfection for no less than 400 days and hickory smoked to achieve a deep mahogany color. The Edwards name is well known for its world-class aged and cured meats. Their exclusive curing and aging recipe produces a unique flavor profile that enhances the quality characteristics of Berkshire pork. Optimum amounts of pure white fat marbling contribute to a flavor that's a delicate, perfect balance between sweet and salty. For more information, visit edwardsvaham.com.
Welcome back to Taste Matters. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis, and I'm talking with Liz Newmark, author of Sylvia's Table and founder of Great Performances, and the farmer, I'm putting that in quotes, of Catch Key Farms, because as she said earlier, if you want to start a farm, talk to her first. She knows a lot more about it now than when she started. And let's get into Sylvia Center, and I want to use that as a segue to talk about some of your civic food system, food access work, because I know I go to a lot of meetings, and either your name comes up or you're participating in them, because I think perhaps through the farm and through operating a very successful New York-based business, you have become involved in some really important policy things at a time when people are listening and trying to make some change. So tell us a little bit about the center, and then let's take it beyond that.
Sure. Sylvia Center, we founded it. It was founded in 06. We're a 501c3, and we are a bifurcated program, which means that we have programs up at the farm, at Catch Key Farm, which is where we started, 2-acre children's garden, and it's a one-day experience where children come, they harvest, they plant, and they cook. And we have an open-air field house with a great pizza oven, and they eat together. So the emphasis on the program is really on the cooking, on the culinary piece.
Okay.
And then here in New York City, we are in about 7 or 8 different NYCHA, New York City Housing Authority, community centers.
Oh.
And in those situations, it's a 6-week program where we work with our kids twice a week. And there are young kids, so 6, 7, 8. We have teenagers, and then we work with families.
And so why is it important for them to cook? Why do you emphasize cooking? You said earlier, just before our break, that people are intimidated about cooking, but so who cares?
Well, there's so much concern about obesity, diet-related diseases. If you're going to ask a young person to think about changing their lifestyle and they don't know how to cook for themselves, how are they really going to make a change? You know, aside from all the other benefits of what happens when a family or individuals together are cooking food, which we know is, mm-hmm. is so powerful. So, you know, our idea was that we sort of plant little seeds. Mm. We turn these kids on to great flavors, fresh food, freshly cooked food. And, you know, we celebrate food every day. We talk about the restaurants and the stores and whatnot. Well, I think children who have not had exposure to that can fall in love with food, too. So that's part of what we do with them, and teaching them how to cook really empowers them to develop more skills that will help them become lifelong, hopefully, better eaters.
Mm-hmm. And then there is this table, this eating together aspect, which right. which is about food and health, but also I think about the socialization of citizens. I mean, caring people, noticing others. To me, there's a piece of that we sometimes forget at the Beard House. It's what we do. We bring people literally to the table. Most of those people come to tables. It's not unique, right. But something happens there besides eating together.
It's community. It's conversation. You know, we all know from growing up how important it was to have those family meals, and it sort of deepens the respect that these children have for the process, because grabbing fast food is a totally different experience, a life experience, and also a food experience than sitting down to a meal that you've prepared together.
Mm. I should remind people listening that they can call in. We have a few minutes left and a few other topics to get to. Our phone number at the studio is 718-497-2128. Or you can email us a question at info@heritageradionetwork.org. If you prefer to tweet, as many people do, although I've already heard Twitter's so passe, I can't even believe I'm giving a Twitter handle. But we're at Taste Matters HRN, if for that old-fashioned social media message that you want to give us. And write us, even if you're listening to us on the archive or on iTunes, which many of you do, because we'll try to get an answer to you, or we'll talk about your question on air. So from Sylvia Center, I mean, you have, you're a third generation New Yorker, and I'll put in brackets in Manhattan, particularly, we were talking before we got on the air about, you know, the different communities that we come to associate with New York City. And you have seen a lot of changes. You've been involved in many of those changes. What's your state of affairs? We're in a transition period right now with a new mayor for the first time in a very long time. But let's talk about food and what you've seen in food access.
Well, you know, I think it's interesting because what I love is, having been in this industry for about 30 years, and you can really see such a narrow slice of life. Everybody I work with professionally pretty much is, you know, they're successful businesses, successful individuals, you know, they've got the money, the access, everything. And if that's all there was, I think it would have gotten a little boring. Mm. So for us as a company, for me as an individual, to look at all the eaters, so those who don't have access are hungry, mm-hmm. just, you know, it's the haves and have not of the food world, and to be able to bring everybody together in our vision is very powerful and very, very meaningful. Mm-hmm. I think the whole farm to table movement has gone from being you know, something cool and new and what is that. And it's really exploded into a much wider understanding of food equality, food inequality, access, the importance of education. I mean, we see what's going on in the public schools. Mm-hmm. We see the anti-hunger movement. Mm-hmm. And I think the more we think about food and connect to it, the more we see the global picture.
Interesting. I think we have a caller with a question.
Hi there.
Hello. You're
on
there.
Excellent. My name is Robin, and the question I had for the guest Liz is, recently a lot of the people in the food movement, like Eric Schlosser and Michael Pollan, among others, actually Raj Patel as well, have recognized that there's a disconnect in the food movement between those that really want and enjoy sustainable and delicious food and the treatment of the food workers who prepare and serve it. So I was just curious, for her as an employer of a large number of food workers herself and on the farm, just what she feels about that kind of connection of labor and the treatment of laborers as well as how that connects to food and food justice, as well as, you know, delicious food in front of the table.
Sure. Great question, Robin. We were talking a little bit about that before we got on the air. Liz?
I think labor is the most important ingredient in our workplace, because without labor, whether it's people preparing the food or people delivering the food, you know, it just doesn't happen. We see it at the farm, how important it is. And I think sensitivity to the needs of our colleagues, because I don't think about them as workers, I think about them as colleagues, is really important. So it comes from looking at how we handle minimum wage issues, which is not an issue for us because we're not in that space. But, you know, respect on all levels, from healthcare, working conditions, that's all critical, a critical conversation for us to have on a national level.
And some of those conversations, because national level is so hard, are happening on the city level, which I think poses some challenges, especially in a city like New York. We see other cities around the country trying to enforce higher minimum wage, which make it difficult from the business perspective if just across the street there's a different situation. I mean, how do we, you know, where do you think we're going in New York with that? I know that you are not in that space because right. you have a different model, really, but a lot of the people in the food industry take a lot of the heat, and the food industry itself opposes a lot of the changes because of the margins and those sorts yeah. of things.
I think one is minimum wage. I think everybody has to give on that. Mm. I don't think we're going to see it jump to 15. I don't think that's reasonable. I think that's a great negotiating strategy, because anything less will seem more reasonable. But it's got to be dealt with. And then immigration. Reform has to be dealt right. with. That's a huge issue, huge from an agricultural perspective and from a food service perspective.
They are the invisible people behind all of these things, the immigrants who, you know, it's an emotional level, and yet it's a very practical, real situation that has to be addressed.
Yeah, I always think of Stephen Colbert, who said he would love to work on a farm. He thinks it's great work. He would like to be in the air-conditioned tent as he picks his green beans.
Yeah, right.
So welcome to reality.
Right, exactly. Thank you for that great question. In terms of, so where do you think we're going in food? Let's get back to the yumminess in food. You have your pulse on what's happening in restaurants and cultural institutions and huge events in this city. Like, what are people, what inspires you about the changes that you see and how they come down to the contracts for the events they're dealing with, or what's happening out there?
Well, I think we see a couple of different trends. Mm-hmm. On one hand, meat could not be more of the moment. I know, everything with bacon.
We just heard that on our commercial when we started at the top of the show, bacon.
Unbelievable.
That's funny, in the middle of this moment where actually we're kind of getting away from that in theory also.
So that's just one of the dichotomies. Mm. It's meat, 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 meat. You look at all the new restaurants, probably 80 to 90% of them are meat-centric. It's
right.
just unbelievable.
Amazing.
And yet, on the other hand, we have people like Michael Pollan and all these other eaters, and especially in this great borough of Brooklyn, you know, the yeah. hotbed of new ideas, where it's no meat,
right?
Less meat. I think politically we're going to have to look at a future where instead of 8 ounces of that piece of protein, steak, whatever it is, it has to go to 4 ounces, not only because of supply and demand and price, but from a health perspective.
And 8 ounces, many people listening would think, is a tiny steak already. So if we're talking steaks.
You see, know, in my right. perfect world, it's a small little piece of meat, and instead of the traditional starch and the veggie, maybe there's, you know, some great vegetable starch and or grain, which mm-hmm. which is really healthier, and a bunch of different vegetables.
And do you see clients willing to make that leap? It's finding value without that giant piece of protein yet, or are we not there yet?
It's
are they not
all
there yet?
An educational yeah. process. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Yeah, you know, we see the start of it, and if you were going to ask me about a trend, you know, the biggest trends that I see and that I think are really important, because it's more than just this meal, it's looking at the bigger food picture, is that it's got to be a better balance. Mm. And there have to be more grains. Grains are fantastic. Mm. And from a taste perspective, we should all fall in love with them, and they have their sexy moments. And the same, I mean, who thought we'd be eating kale, yeah, you know, king kale?
You have a whole chapter practically on kale, which I love, that it's just become the sexy thing. Unbelievable.
And what's really interesting is that in my complete and total total lack of vision, I asked Farmer Bob to never plant kale. Okay, he did not listen to me.
Hysterical. Good for him. Well, somehow half an hour has passed, and it felt like 5 minutes. I hope that everyone listening wants more. To get more of Liz Newmark, you should pick up a copy of Sylvia's Table. It's full of interesting stories, some local culture, some of her observations from her career in food, about the importance not just of the farm, but of really knowing how to cook and some of the things that we've been talking about today. It's always a pleasure to chat with you, Liz. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much. What a great start to the year.
Thanks. Next week, we are going to welcome Alan Richman, who is a often controversial critic, who works for GQ, now mainly GQ.com, but one of the most gifted food writers and one of the funniest people I know. And we're going to have a conversation, I am sure, about all sorts of wacky perspectives that he has on food trends happening. Please join us. In the meantime, eat some grains. Do what Liz said. Explore some grains this week before we hear from you next Wednesday. And remember that taste matters. Bye.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.